It is Tuesday, November 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Russian President Vladimir Putin warns Ukraine against taking part in reckless acts. A bomb kills three U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan.
What we understand from the statement that the Taliban has issued is that it was a planted device, a roadside bomb, basically.
And migrant soccer players are winning hearts in Spain. It's all ahead. Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning Ukraine against committing any reckless acts as Ukraine imposed martial law after Russian forces seized three Ukrainian ships and their crews in the Black Sea. The Kremlin said Putin told German Chancellor Angela Merkel in a phone conversation that he was seriously concerned about the developments. He asked Germany to approach Ukrainian authorities to dissuade them from further reckless acts. The Ukrainian parliament approved President Petro Poroshenko's call for martial law for 30 days in territory near the Russian border after expressing concern about a possible land invasion. The United States was among a number of Western countries that condemned Russia's seizure of the Ukrainian vessels and the capture of two dozen Ukrainian sailors Sunday off the coast of Russian-annexed Crimea. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo condemned what he called this aggressive Russian action. He called for the return of the ships and crew members and respect for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. President Donald Trump was asked about the incident as he left the White House for a campaign event.
We do not like what's happening either way. We don't like what's happening, and hopefully it'll get straightened out. I know Europe is not thrilled. They're working on it, too. We're all working on it together.
Russia called the incident a planned provocation by Ukraine. A Russian UN diplomat accused Kiev of illegally crossing Russia's border and ignoring calls to move normally through the Kerch Strait. Alexei Muraviev is an associate professor of national security and strategic studies at Curtin University in Perth, Australia. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he does not believe Russia has any interest in a war with Ukraine.
Whilst the Ukrainians may feel vulnerable, the general staff reported the concentration of over 800 Russian aircraft in the proximity of Ukrainian borders and 25 tactical battalion groups. I don't think Ukraine should expect a full-scale invasion. Having said that, I can expect an escalation of tensions in eastern parts of Ukraine where the Ukrainian government forces are confronted by Russia-backed separatists.
Why did this happen?
Ukraine has declared an interest in building up its naval capability in the Sea of Azov. Early in the year, Ukrainian bodyguards seized a couple of Russian flagged vessels, arrested their crews on grounds that they were fishing in waters adjacent to Ukrainian territorial waters with their exclusive economic zone. Some of these crew remain detained in Ukraine to date. Russian bodyguards have increased inspections and slowed down the process of allowing foreign flag vessels reaching Ukrainian ports in the Sea of Azov. This time, the Ukrainian warships wanted to exercise the right of free passage by entering Russian territorial waters, but their transporters, according to Russian bodyguard service, were turned off. The Russians claimed that they have failed to file paperwork for the transit through the strait in time. Their guns were pointing at Russian warships. They engaged them. They tried to divert them. The Ukrainians didn't stop. They maintained their course. As a result, the Russians ran into one of the Ukrainian ships. They opened fire and stormed all three vessels, taking the crew prisoner and escorting ships to the Sea of Azov. So the Russians believe that they acted in accordance with their national law. The Ukrainians believe that they were acting under 2003 bilateral agreement between the two countries, and they also don't recognize Russian sovereignty over Crimea, believing that all waters surrounding Crimea are not part of Russian territorial waters rather than the part of the Ukrainian territorial waters.
Can this matter be diffused peacefully soon?
I don't really see any prospect that the Russians would release captured Ukrainian personnel anytime soon. Russian media reports that they are likely to be trialed under Russian law as violators of Russia's boundaries. The Russians claim that they captured two intelligence officers who were on board of this ship, so these people are likely to be detained probably longer. Even the crew may be released as a gesture of goodwill.
Alexei Muravyev of Curtin University in Perth, Australia. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A German man who bombed a pro-soccer team bus is sentenced to 14 years in prison. In Britain, Uber is fined $1.2 million for a 2016 data breach. Hong Kong Democrats are eyeing rural political reform, and NASA's latest Mars probe successfully lands on the red planet. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA's new Mars lander, the Interior Exploration, using seismic investigations, geodesy, and heat transport, or InSight, touched down safely on the red planet on November 26th at 1952 Universal Time. InSight Mission Control at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory announced the touchdown.
Touchdown confirmed. InSight is on the surface of Mars.
The spacecraft, launched on May 5, 2018, survived a nearly seven-month, 485 million kilometer journey through space and a perilous seven-minute landing procedure. InSight will be the space agency's first mission that will be devoted to exploring the interior structure of Mars. Scientists hope that InSight will provide some evidence about the formation and evolution of all rocky planets, including Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at a new climate report that paints a dire picture of climate change. The U.S. military in Afghanistan says three of its service members were killed and three others wounded when an improvised explosive device went off near the troubled central eastern city of Ghazni. An American contractor was also wounded in the blast. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the attack. Reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad, Pakistan, tells me what is known about Tuesday's attack.
Well, what we understand from the statement that NATO's Resolute Support Mission has issued is that this was an improvised device, but no details of exactly where it happened or how it happened were given. But what we understand from the statement that the Taliban has issued is that it was a planted device, a roadside bomb, basically, that they had planted to target the American convoy that was passing through that area, which is near the provincial capital of Ghazni. And when it, you know, that's where it exploded, the bomb exploded, and it caused these casualties, which is very significant in terms of the U.S. casualties, because three soldiers died in one incident is quite rare in Afghanistan in recent years. So that was quite a blow. And as we know, this is Ghazni. You know, Ghazni has been the scene of intense Taliban attacks for the last several months. This is an important province in a way that it is located on a road which links northern Afghanistan to southern Afghanistan, and that is where Ghazni is located. And in this province, we understand both from the insurgent sources and the Afghan government is that several districts in Ghazni province, it's the capital and the province have both the same name. So several districts are currently under the control of the Taliban, and the remaining districts, other than the provincial capital, the Taliban are hotly contesting it. And only a few weeks ago, the insurgents were close to capturing Ghazni, the provincial capital, and that's when the American forces were called in to help the Afghan forces to push the Taliban out of the provincial capital.
It sounds as though the Taliban has become more active in this region recently.
Yes, that's true, because Taliban understand the importance of this part of Afghanistan. This is Ghazni is also like it's central eastern Afghanistan, and it is close to some central provinces like Bamiyan, where we have Shiite Hazara community as most of the population, and that's where Taliban have launched some operations in recent days in this province. So it seems that the effort by the insurgent group is to create influence along this entire stretch so that Afghan forces find it quite difficult in terms of moving from north to south or south to north if Taliban permanently, if they establish bases and pockets in this area. That will be really challenging for Afghan forces, and it will increase threat to the capital, Kabul, because you have to, this road passing through Kabul leads to northern Afghanistan. So it seems that they are eyeing on this area and on this province and in central and central eastern Afghan provinces to create more problems for the beleaguered Afghan security forces, which have really suffered heavy casualties. And we know only recently, earlier this month, President Ashraf Ghani for the first time revealed that in the last 3 years, Afghan security forces have lost nearly 29,000 personnel, which is very significant, like more than 9,000 soldiers per year. And that shows the kind of, you know, influence the Taliban have been extending and expanding over the country.
Ayaz Ghul reporting from Islamabad. By the year 2090, when days are too hot or too smoggy to work, it will cost the U.S. economy up to $155 billion each year in lost productivity. That's one economic impact cited in the National Climate Assessment released Friday by 13 U.S. federal agencies. It states that without substantial and sustained global mitigation and regional adaptation efforts, climate change is expected to cause growing losses to American infrastructure and property and impede the rate of economic growth over this century. President Donald Trump, when asked about the report Monday, dismissed it as alarmist.
I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it.
Trump has for many years rejected the scientific consensus that human activities are the main drivers of climate change. Since his first day in office, he has worked to undo regulations that aim to cut the greenhouse gas emissions that are warming the planet.
Right now, we're at the cleanest we've ever been, and that's very important to me. But if we're clean, but every other place on Earth is dirty, that's not so good. So I want clean air, I want clean water, very important.
The report said deaths from extreme temperatures will cause $141 billion in losses per year. The analysis points out that this is no longer something that will happen, but that it is happening. Dr. Peter Gleck, a world-renowned climate expert and founder of the Pacific Institute, who worked on the original climate assessment, spoke with International Edition's Lori London.
Well, this is a study that was done by 13 federal agencies, and it was prepared under a law that requires the U.S. to do an assessment every few years of the risks of climate change for the United States. This is the fourth national climate assessment, and what it tells us is really what we've sort of known all along, which is we know that humans are causing climate change, not something in the future, but happening now. We see more and more actual impacts today of climate change in terms of changes in our water resources and our snow and our temperatures and fire frequency and sea level rise, all of the things that unfortunately we're witnessing every day. And it says we need to act to make sure that we're prepared for those impacts we can't avoid, and we work to reduce future impacts to prevent them from being even worse.
Is it possible to reverse this in any way if there was enough action, or is it really just too late for that? And is it more a question of just literally preparing for what's to come?
There are two pieces to that. We are now in a world in which we know humans are already changing the climate. That is unavoidable. And so we have to prepare for those impacts that we can no longer avoid, that in fact, many of which we're starting to see. But at the same time, we also have to work as hard as possible to reduce the emissions of the gases that are causing climate change so that we don't continue to accelerate the bad changes that are happening. And it's possible to reverse that in some ways. We're not going to stop climate change, but we can certainly slow it down. And it's going to take a long time now, but eventually we're going to have to work to even get rid of some of the greenhouse gases we put into the atmosphere.
Considering that we've been hearing about this for many years, and my understanding is that the level of carbon emissions that are going into the atmosphere have not been reduced at all.
Well, the rate of increase has been reduced. The first thing you have to do is slow the accelerating train, which we're beginning to do now. You know, we're seeing much more aggressive investment in renewable energy. Coal plants are closing in many places. There's a tremendous amount that needs to be done, but we are slowly making progress. The bad news from this report is that we are already experiencing impacts of human-caused climate change, and we're going to have to deal with that as well.
What kinds of things are we going to have to deal with?
Well, the bad news is there's just a huge long list of them, but we know that sea level is going up, and we know that poses enormous threats to our coastal communities. And again, we've seen with recent hurricanes the damage that's possible from these extreme events along the coast. We know the temperatures are going up, and we've seen the impact of rising temperatures on fire frequency and fire intensity and fire speed in the western United States. We know that we're losing our snowpack in the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Nevadas in the west because of rising temperatures, and that affects water resources and water quality. The report also talks about basically broad impacts on the economy. It says we could lose 10% of our economy by 2100 just dealing with climate impacts. So, you know, this isn't some abstract thing. This is our economy. This is our health. This is our lives. And that's one of the reasons why this report is so important.
Obviously, climate change doesn't just impact people here in the United States. This is a global problem. What do we as a country do, or can we do, as far as solutions to an administration that seems hostile to the science? The president just Monday said he doesn't believe the report.
Yeah, it's very hard to have coordinated global action on this global problem without the active participation of the United States and the fact that we have an administration that is so hostile to actual science. And as long as that's the case at the federal level, as long as we're not as a country participating in global efforts, it's going to slow the globe's ability to deal with this problem, and it's going to worsen the impacts in the long run. The good news is that even without federal action, we see states and local communities taking action. The state of California has a very aggressive program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we're not the only state here to do that.
And we have two more years, possibly six, with this administration. I would imagine those would be 2 to 6 years lost. How detrimental to the world would that be?
It's a big deal. The impacts that we see today are the consequence of not having taken action 10 and 20 years ago to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. If we had paid attention to the science information that we had 20 years ago when the first national climate assessment came out, the impacts we'd be seeing today would be much less. And so the longer we delay addressing greenhouse gas emissions, the longer we delay cutting the concentrations in the atmosphere, the worse those impacts are going to be. We can't afford to lose any more time, really.
Dr. Peter Glick, a climate expert and founder of the Pacific Institute. He spoke with International Edition's Lori London. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
This is International Edition. Young soccer players around the world dream of following in their heroes' footsteps and going to Europe to play for top teams like Barcelona. A group of mainly African migrants has taken a first step and, with the help of a sympathetic coach, formed a team in the Spanish leagues. As Henry Ridgewell reports from the southern city of Jerez, the club offers far more than a weekend kickabout for the young men, many of whom have risked their lives to reach Spanish shores.
Sunday morning in the suburbs of Jerez, and two local teams are battling relegation. The third tier of the Andalusian League may not attract many spectators, but for the players of Alma de Africa, football means family. The team, whose name means Soul of Africa, is made up of migrants plus a few locals to help integrate the newcomers. In the shadow of the elaborate Jerez de la Frontera railway station, the players enjoy a post-match coffee. Among them is Modu Ndiaye, who left his home in Senegal 2 years ago. Ndiaye says he and others took a boat from Senegal to the island of Tenerife and that the journey took 10 days. He says it was really hard and everyone thought the group wouldn't make it. He says they ran out of drinking water and suffered a lot. Thanks to God, he says, they reached their destination. Ndiaye's teammate, Bashir Aldaf, arrived in Jerez just 2 months ago. Aldaf says he was a footballer in his country, and on the day he arrived in Spain, asked around for a team to play with. Aldaf says he went to Jerez Football Club for 2 weeks, but the coach told him he couldn't play because he lacked the right papers. Aldaf says the coach told him to go and find Alma de Africa. Alma de Africa was born 3 years ago when locals spotted a group of migrants playing football in a park. The players would often argue, so the locals found a referee and in stepped Alejandro Benitez. On the pitch, Benitez saw talent. Off it, he recognised deep vulnerability. So he set up a team and persuaded the Spanish football leagues to let them play. He says they started from nothing and invested their own money, adding that every year, however, the team has to start from scratch. Benitez appears to be a father figure for many of the players. His role as president extends well beyond the club. Benitez says at the end of the match, we cannot let them go back to their old way of living, selling stuff at traffic signals, washing cars. He says they need more than footballs. He says they need apartments to avoid living on the streets and classes so they can learn the language more quickly. He says they need support to get them into the labour market, to show that diversity is not negative but positive. Claiming asylum and getting the right legal papers can take years. Finding steady work is all but impossible. Despite the support of the club, Aldaf is finding it tough. He says that before, he believed life would be better in Spain, but it's very difficult without a job. Alma de Africa supports a handful of the tens of thousands of migrants arriving every year in Spain. It also aims to change attitudes through a shared passion. On the pitch, the team is struggling. The bigger challenge is to find the money to keep this football family moving forward. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Jerez, Spain.
Thanks very much, Henry. Well, in other news, anthropologists, researchers, and an international rights group have urged authorities to call off the search for the body of an American who was presumably killed by a secluded tribe, saying that the move poses a risk to the hunter-gatherer tribe. John Allen Chow went to the prohibited North Sentinel Island off the Indian mainland on a mission to convert the tribe to Christianity. Tribe members reportedly shot him dead with arrows. Fishermen said they spotted tribe members dragging and burying the body in the sand. Well, that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media.
In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated one quarter of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. Two-thirds of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity